This episode of Tales from Ostlantis is brought to you by Ostlantis Premium. Don't you just hate having your favorite podcast interrupted by ads like this? Well, dear listener, you're in luck. Because starting at just $3 a month, you can support independent Chicano media and receive ad-free episodes, premium episodes, bonus content, and access to our Discord server. Just visit talesfromostlantis.com and click Go Premium, or follow the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show.
You must excuse me. I've grown quite weary.
This hasn't been easy, I know. But you've learned a lesson. A lesson in honesty. Honesty to yourself and honesty to others. That lesson will stand you in good stead all your life.
I think we've all learned a good lesson. I've always heard that honesty is the best policy. Now I'm catching on to why that's so,
so. Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to yet a very special bonus mini episode of Tales from Ostlantis. I am your co-host, as always, Curly Tlapoyawa, and this episode is going to be coming to you from the 89th annual meeting of the SAAs, which went down in New Orleans. And the SAA stands for Society for American Archaeology, of which I am a proud member. And I gave a couple of talks at this last SAAs, and it was a lot of fun. I got to see some old friends, meet some new friends, and take in the sights in New Orleans. And this was coming off the tail end of I don't like to call it a debate. There was a discussion that happened on the Joe Rogan Experience, the Joe Rogan podcast, between my friend Flint Dibble, Dr. Flint Dibble, professor of zooarchaeology at Cardiff, and a not-so-archaeologist. In fact, some would call him a pseudo-archaeologist by the name of Graham Hancock. And by some may call him that. I would include myself in that. I consider him a pseudo-archaeologist and not by any means a legitimate or accurate portrayer of the archaeological record. And what happened was Joe Rogan welcomed Flint Dibble onto the show, where he had this discussion with Graham Hancock to talk about some of the pseudo-archaeological claims that Graham Hancock likes to put out there in the world. And I'm proud to say that I was able to help out in this endeavor. If you listen to the show in its entirety, and I think it's something like 4.5 hours long, it's a rather long discussion, but it's well worth a listen if you have the time or desire to check it out. I strongly and highly recommend that you do so. But I made a little cameo appearance during the discussion. Flint asked if I would record make a previously recorded video that he could air on the Joe Rogan show when it came to the topic of expertise and why context matters. And also featured on the discussion was friend of mine and colleague and Oaxaca archaeologist Marika Stahl. And I ran into Marika at the SAAs, and she was kind enough to take some time to talk to me for the podcast. So I decided to make it a little bonus mini episode. It's not very long, but I think you'll enjoy the content. So, without further ado, Fear and Loathing at the SAAs. All right, so we are here at the SAAs in beautiful New Orleans, and I'm standing here with the one and only Marika Stahl. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I had a great symposium yesterday on Oaxacan archaeology, and we're bringing together Mexican, American, and Canadian archaeologists, and basically trying to build bridges between the two different research communities. And every year it gets bigger and better.
Awesome. So the conference is going well for you?
Yes, it is. And in fact, I'm now on the Committee of the Americas, and yesterday I pushed for more equity for archaeologists that live outside the United States.
So that's because you live in Oaxaca, right?
Yes, I live in Miahuatlán de Porfirio Díaz in Oaxaca, Mexico. So I'm very much surrounded by and involved with indigenous culture there. And living there, you just kind of, the whole idea that objects are animated or places are animated is not a surprising thing to me, because that's the way the people treat it and that's what they teach you. And so I'm here to fight the good fight for them.
Sweet. Speaking of fighting the good fight, mm-hmm. you made a cool little cameo appearance on the recent conversation. I'm not going to call it a debate because it wasn't a debate, because we don't debate science. You publish, mm-hmm. but you were part of that great conversation on Joe Rogan mm-hmm. with Flint Dibble and that other guy. And so have you gotten any response from that? Have you gotten any feedback?
I've gotten feedback from Flint, who absolutely loved it. And he said that both your video, Curly, and mine came really in handy, especially when who shall not be named, was trying to push his nonsense. And I have gotten responses about it. The archaeology community has been talking a lot about that conversation. And I'm really glad that I had that opportunity, because one of the things that has always bothered me about what he who shall not be named, what he pushes as his agenda, is he says that archaeologists do not engage with indigenous myth, right? But he cherry picks what he wants, right? Mm-hmm. And so the story he picks happens to be a myth or a story that was written down 100 years after the conquest, right, by Hispanicized indigenous scribes who had been instructed and taught by Spanish priests. And so this story carries a lot of Christian overtones. For example, it's supposed to be a fight, right, in Tula, between Quetzalcoatl, who's a poet and a man of peace, versus Tezcatlipoca, who's him and his followers wanted to promote human sacrifice. Well, there's obviously a real problem with that story from the beginning, and where I would put the problem is that the enemy is someone who practices human sacrifice, because that's not how sacrifice, human, animal, of objects, of buildings, or whatever, was understood within the indigenous ontology in Mesoamerica, or all across the Americas in general. What I've argued before in an article in Ancient Mesoamerica about the ball games, right, is that within the indigenous framework, there's a sense of reciprocal obligations. So if I do something for you, at some point you're going to do something for me. Si me das, te doy. Te amo, me amas, right? And it's what I learned from my ethnography with ball players is that there's a sort of, a give and take relationship. And if you don't participate in it, you do lose your, what they call the calidad moral, or your moral quality. And so one town issues an invitation to a team, for example, and that team accepts, but then they don't show up, well, then that team that doesn't show up can expect that they won't be invited elsewhere, or if they invite other people won't show up. And so that's why it's just like reciprocal obligations, because while, there's no law forcing you to do this, there's social obligations. You could be shunned if you do not participate in the system. But in that way, it explains the sort of the relationships between not only the individual and the community, but also between the community and the cosmos. And the idea is that the gods, or the deities, right, they invented the world, they gave corn to the people, and it's sort of an obligation on the people then to reciprocate that. And so human sacrifice a lot of times was seen as paying that debt or feeding the gods. They feed us, we feed them. as opposed to the idea of human sacrifice in the Abrahamic tradition, where sacrifice is a form of punishment. So the idea that the enemy in this story, or the bad guy, would be someone who practiced human sacrifice, but the good guy would be some like peaceful Jesus-like figure, is completely wrong. And if he who shall not be named was an actual expert in these things, he would know that. No, instead he picks the myth that posits Quetzalcoatl as some sort of white god savior.
Yeah.
Which is really highly problematic. So in my video, I cited a myth that comes from, I think, the Codex Mesoamericanus, which was created in the 16th century, but prior to the arrival of the Spanish, because it's on deer hide with native paints. And it tells the story of the creation of the world at Apolola. And in that story, the gods gather. One of them goes down into the underworld and comes back with mushrooms. They take a mushroom ceremony. And Lord Nine Wind, as he's known in the Mixtec mythology, they all consume it. But then he starts playing music by scraping a stone around a human skull. And he cries as a result of the mushrooms. And then they create the known world at Apolola. Not Cholula's he who shall not be named claims. But anyway, this is a very different picture of Quetzalcoatl than that heavily Christianized myth.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of what I tried to point out, was that, again, he cherry picks data. And he claims that we do not engage with these myths, but we don't engage with the myths that we know come from a post-conquest period. We engage with myths that are actually indigenous.
Yeah, and then there's the what they like to call the hermeneutics of suspicion, right? Like mm-hmm. when you do engage with the post-colonial stuff, it's done in a certain
way.
You're using it a certain lens to analyze these
exactly.
things.
Exactly. As one of my professors said, you read with the text and you read against the text, right? So when you're doing a metatextual analysis, right, you're kind of looking at what are the author's intentions? What are they trying to do? And I think in some respects, a lot of these indigenous scribes, they're the sons of the people who are, or grandsons of the people who were originally conquered. And they've been educated by Spanish priests. There's still a lot of trauma going on. They're trying to understand what happened. And so they're looking back and trying to find reasons for it, which is why I think, you know, there's all those stories about Moctezuma and him ignoring signs. But when you actually look at what happened, it's like Moctezuma's so strong. He was, like, interested in these visitors. He didn't know what to do with them. And then the Spanish one day decided to up and murder him.
Mm-hmm.
They committed regicide, which is why Cortez had to write all these letters and had to justify what he did and why originally they wanted to take him back in chains, because he had violated a law. He had killed a king.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they got chased out. You know, yeah, 100 years later, people are trying to, like, figure out what happened. And so they come up with all these myths, and then Moctezuma comes out looking like a weak fool. And that's not what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he seems, the guy on Joe Rogan,
mm-hmm.
he seems to always pick the stories or the myths that most closely align with the narrative that he's specifically trying to push, and he ignores.
Mm-hmm.
So he likes to accuse us of ignoring things, but he's very selective about the way he presents his information.
Yeah, what he chooses. And I think, you know, if I were going to analyze it from an armchair, and again, I don't know him personally, so this is like simply what I've observed. He is the son of British missionaries who grew up during the waning days of British Empire. And so was very much formed by this idea of the white man's burden, that other people come from other places to bring knowledge, to bring railroads, to bring knowledge of the Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not surprising to me that he would take ayahuasca and then suddenly, like, instead of seeing the connections between human beings about how we're all the same species, and we like, you know, have similar experiences, but we also kind of interpret them in particular ways depending on our particular context, social, cultural, and environmental context. Instead of understanding that, instead, like, his brain reached back to his childhood, where he was a child of missionaries, bringing knowledge to the naive brown people who are unaware of the Christian God, and that carries over to what he argues for now. So I see no difference between what his dad was doing as a missionary and what he argues for now. And I know he doesn't like being accused of this label, but in a way, like what he is pushing is a form of white supremacism and racism.
Well, yeah, he would have to be very disingenuous or just flat out obtuse not to be able to look at these stories and see how they're connected to racism because he likes to deflect that. Like, well, I'm not racist, you know, and then he'll be like, my wife's black or whatever stupid excuse he brings.
My God. Yeah. And as someone with, I love my father, but as someone with a conservative father who does sometimes use his brown wife and children as a defense against his own racism, I think I highly resent that. And I know I have said some kind of mean things on Twitter about it, but at the same time, as a reaction perhaps from my own trauma, but that's a reaction against it, because he will bring up the fact that his wife is a person of color, and that's just deflection. So, but it's still, at the same time, he's still arguing that these brown people were too stupid to stack stones on top of each other and put seeds in the ground, and that they had to be shown by some advanced civilization coming from elsewhere. And what's really funny is, if you watch episode 2 of the first season of Ancient Apocalypse, when he's talking about the intellectual giants that brought this knowledge to them, first of all, they look very kind of Middle Eastern Israeli with their beards and their long hair, which is funny. But also, in that cartoon, they show this Quetzalcoatl guy, right, this figure, but he's standing in the middle of Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, because they show the double temple with Huitzilopochtli and Tlaloc. And I always laugh when I see that, because, okay, that doesn't prove your point.
Yeah.
Because by then, Tenochtitlan, I mean, they'd had farming and they were building temples for 1,000, 2,000 years at that point. At least you could have picked, like, I don't know, La Consentida in the coast of Oaxaca, which we know is a early formative site that's, like, at least at this point 4,000 years old. And it's, like, some of the first evidence of public monuments, probably built by semi-nomadic groups, and it's on the Oaxacan coast. Why would you do your cartoon drawing with Tenochtitlan, which comes at the very end of this sequence? And the Aztecs were doing, or the Mexica, the Tenochtitlan Mexica had the chinampas, the raised beds around the lake. So they had very sophisticated agricultural technology, and yet that's what you show in your show, and we're supposed to take you seriously? Please. No manches. Sorry.
Well, I just want to thank you for your work for doing that video for the debate that happened on Joe Rogan. I thought Flint did great.
Yes, I thought he did too.
It was just an absolute ass kicking.
It was.
I didn't think that homeboy was prepared, or that he thought that he was going to get hit with so much data and research.
Because what he's used to is being able to just speak off the cuff and have people believe him because he has a British accent. Yeah. And I guess when Americans hear someone saying, it's absurd.
Yeah.
They like, oh my God, this person must be so intelligent. They have a British accent. So. But no, Flint did a very good job, and I was also say I was delighted by Joe Rogan.
Interestingly enough, that took me by surprise.
It took me by surprise too. But I remember when I saw a couple episodes of him years ago, when he would have actual academics on, including a paleontologist. And it was really
before. I remember that episode.
Yes, yeah, and he was actually very interested. So when you can like break through to him, He will ask good questions and be reasonable. And so I was, I also wanted to say good job, Joe Rogan, too.
Yeah.
Both Flint and Joe were good in the debate. He who shall not be named was just flustered. So, yeah.
Awesome.
That proves where he is.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak to me.
Yes. Thank you so much, Curly, for inviting me to speak to you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And Yeah, we're here at the SAA's 2014. Are there?
2024.
2014. God damn, that's how drunk I am.
Yes, well, you know, as an explanation for the audience, we've been here for 3 days, and sometimes in order to avoid la cruda, you have to keep going.
Timoitas.
Thank you for listening to Tales from Aztlantis, a project of the Chimali Institute of Mesoamerican Arts. If you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter. You can do this by visiting talesfromaztlantis.com and clicking Support the Podcast. Your continued support will help keep the podcast ad-free and independent. Until next time, Timoitase.